Hello and welcome back to the Indie Film Toolkit Podcast. This is episode 20. We are in the two digits, but we've already been 2 digits. We are in the 20s.
This is our second decade.
Yeah.
This is our second decade.
I'm your host, Wade Wojcik, joined by Ben Robertson.
Hello.
David Ishida's here as well. Back to third billing.
Once again,
you're
third
slipping,
billing.
Man. We got a great episode today. We're going to be talking about the NAB roundup. David's got three cream of the crop items that we're going to be covering.
Woot.
And then for Tricks of the Trade, we're talking about working with established IP. We all the
IP
three of us,
as in intellectual property, yeah. Not internet provider.
Right.
Or internet
that would
protocol.
That would be ISP? Or?
Yes, ISP.
Anyway, we have a three different examples. I'm talking about Microsoft. David's talking about CBS/Star Trek.
CBS/Paramount.
Yeah, and Ben's working from the Star Wars angle. Yeah. And that's going to be really interesting and tie into the movie we saw, which ties in a lot of established IPs, which is Ready Player One. And we all have a lot of thoughts and opinions and feelings about that movie. Hmm. At least I
feelings were had, to
yes,
be sure.
Yeah. So so just to kick it off here. So, David, you went to NAB once again this year.
Yes, I did.
Give us the goods dish on the best and brightest. That,
yeah, who had the best party at NAB?
Yeah, that's the best question.
That's an excellent question. I didn't really go. There weren't really any parties. All the parties this year were pretty bad.
Mm-hmm.
AJA didn't have that. AJA usually has this gargantuan party that they probably spend either between $500,000 and $1 million on, and they didn't do it this year, I think, because the poor sales of the AJA Scion camera have finally caught off with them.
Did that finally come out? Wow.
Oh, no, it's been out for 3 years,
okay.
But it bombed.
Oh,
badly.
I remember.
It was not a good camera.
I remember when it was like being rumored, you were excited about it.
I was very excited about it. Yeah. I think there was like it was going to be a great price point, and it had a great feature set, but in the end, the sensor and color science just looked like garbage. Mm. Just completely unusable out in the field. And, like, if you're doing like in studio shoots all the time, like product stuff, and you have absolute control and you can basically just set up the camera and your lighting and never have to touch it again, it would work great. But if you want to go outside, you're up a creek. Mm. Anyway.
So, walk us through what were some of
NAB.
The highlights.
So, this year at NAB, usually there's a general theme every year at NAB. I think about it was 3 years ago, it was stabilizers, like Ronin's and Movies and all the knockoffs of those. That was 3 years ago. 2 years ago, it was all about drones. Last year, it was all about large format lenses. And this year, it was sort of blah. Mm. This was not a... Like, it was a cool year. There were definitely a lot of cool things. But it was not a standout year for NAB, in my opinion. There wasn't, like, a singular product or genre of product that stood out above all others.
Is there a particular reason for that, do you think?
I don't think so. Mm. Yeah.
Like the year of the iPhone 7 and cell phones, it was like, here's just some more small upgrades.
Yeah, exactly. There's three ones that I do want to call attention to. The first one is a company called eModomo. I saw them last year, and they had a really cool system because they had basically a motion control system. Motion control being very important if you're doing very complex multi-layered shots, as you can repeat the same exact movement over and over again. So if you need to do different plate shots and have things overlap, it's how you can do cool time freeze effects. I know Film Riot has a really cool video about that, and how the way you do it is you have a slider and system that is doing the same move every time, so you can reposition yourselves in every move and then composite them each thing in the same way.
Or the shot that comes to mind is Fellowship of the Ring with Gandalf coming into Bag End. And him, Ian McKellen, interacting with,
on the small set and
combining the large and small set together in one shot,
exactly.
While moving the camera.
Yes, exactly. And so last year they came out that they had a full slider with pan, tilt, and focus control on it, and a slide move on it. It was a really cool system and very inexpensive. I think that rig was in the ballpark of about $3,000 to $4,000, which for a motion control system is very, very cheap. I know there is one up here in Minnesota, one like full on, like takes 4 hours to set up motion control system. And I think that one rents for like $3,000 to $4,000 a day. And you have to hire an operator with it. Hmm. And what they did this year, I thought was very, very clever. So they took their same motion control head. So the head that has pan, tilt, and a focus control all built on as part of it. And then they created a motor and geared, pulley cable attachment for a Dana dolly. I'm not sure if you guys have seen Dana dollies out there, but it's a dolly that's on a speed rail. You get on a speed rail back, and you have that, and it's just a cart that you just set on top of it on skate wheels. And it's a very simple because There's no fancy slider base for it. You just put it on stands.
Right.
You just very use versatile. Speed roll. Yep. So you can... Oh, yeah. We use that on Georgia Rock. You would have seen it on Georgia Rock. And so it's really great because it collapses down so small. And also you can do really long moves. Like, you know, if you want to do a 20-foot long move, you just need two 20-foot pieces of speed rail and you're good to go. Unlike a traditional slider, which, as you guys have probably seen, are, you know, most sliders are between about 20 inches and 4 feet on average. There are exceptions to that, of course. And what's cool about this, as I said, is that it's a motor that attaches to that system, and then you have a full motorized mocap, or motion control, sorry.
Yeah, yeah. I like that because it kind of combines best of both worlds, essentially.
Yep. And it's cool because you actually control it with a PlayStation 4 controller, is the main controller for this thing, because it has all the necessary buttons for every axis you need.
That's the officially licensed, you know, controller for it?
Yep.
Interesting.
Yep.
Oh.
I don't know if it's licensed, but
you use Xbox?
Yeah. That I don't know.
Can I control it with my Switch?
I don't think you can.
How about a potato?
Cool. So what would the application be of using a slider over a dolly system? Or like?
Well, this one specifically because it's motorized. So as I said, so you can do the same exact move. And so it uses stepper motors. And so the nice thing about stepper motors is the motor knows where the drive shaft is, like the position. Like, you know, if you plug in, like, you know, like the motor in a PlayStation 4 controller, the little vibration motor, and you spin it, the motor and by proxy the computer controlling it doesn't know where that drive shaft is. It just know it turned on for X amount of time and that's it. Mm-hmm. With stepper motors, it does know it, and it has like 3,000 like keyframe points, but in each degree in a circle. So it has an obscenely fine amount of control over where it is. So the move can be correct down to the exact frame of video.
So is the primary application for this being something like if you're matching footage for, say, like a CGI shot or something like that?
Yeah, yes. You could do that. And also if you want to do like a really cool time lapses or hyperlapses that include a pan and tilt and whatnot. And also because it has focus built in as part of the system, then you can have focus changes over the course of the move and it will do the same thing every time. And because it can be on this dolly track and you can say, okay, we only need 8 feet. So you have an 8-foot set of pipe and you clamp down this toothed cable on there. And then you just do 8 feet. Or if you want to do 20 feet, you can unroll it to 20 feet and do that whole move. And then you can have it does a mirror move feature. So you can do, okay, I want you to do this. And you do it yourself on the controller and then you just hit repeat. And then it'll just repeat and do the same exact thing over and over and over again.
So how much does this go for?
I believe this system, like if you like just the head is about $2,000, and then I think if you want this new setup for the Dana Dolly, it's about another $1,500 or so. So
it's
again,
reasonable.
In the scheme of things, it's a very, very reasonable system.
Yeah, considering the system you mentioned earlier was like $3,000 or $4,000 to rent today,
yep.
Let's say to hire someone. Cool. So you also mentioned a wooden camera.
Yes. So one thing that is overlooked a lot of the times, especially in indie filmmaking, are follow focuses. And with the main reason for that being is that they are expensive. If you look at, the Airy lightweight follow focus, one of my favorites, that's like $2,000 for that system. There are a lot of really cheap, really, really cheap ones, but they're really, really bad that I think we've all interacted with and used before. Mm-hmm. And so Wooden Camera just came out with a really nice one that's very simple. It's only $500, which, you know, sounds like a lot for basically a gear and a knob. But, you know, as we've all seen in the professional world, when you add a follow focus and you give that much better control to your focus puller to be able to manipulate focus, it really elevates the quality of your shots. Mm-hmm. And it's nice that Wooden Camera is coming out with a system that is so affordable, and it feels very good. Another unique feature of it is that it clamps onto rods, as most follow focus systems do, so you need to have a base plate and 15 millimeter or 19 millimeter rods off of it, and it only clamps onto one of them instead of two.
Oh, cool.
Which makes it lighter weight. I think it just saves on some engineering time and not having to have a system that spans both rods.
Yeah.
And surprisingly, it did seem to hold up to weight pretty well, because that was my big concern, is if it was going to shift too much by not having two pick points. on the rods.
Does it actually clamp or does it slide on?
It slides on and clamps, mm-hmm. yes. I do wish it, like, if it was a double system, then it would just need to clamp on,
sure.
which makes it really fast for removing it.
Yeah.
Because, like, this way, like, if you have a mat box on there as well, then you need to take off the mat box first in order to slide this
hassle.
Up. Yep. So it does take a little extra time, but I don't think they could do a single rod system that just clamped.
Yeah.
I don't think it would have enough strength. Mm-hmm. Only, like, you know, covering, you know, half, you yeah. know, 50% of the rod.
And how much of this is wood? That's the important thing.
That is
I
a very
know.
Good question, and it is zero. There's what? No wood.
But
there's
it's no wooden wood. Camera.
I know.
That's my favorite part about that brand.
So named because I think even to a point now, a lot of times when they're designing things, they actually, and they have it all over their booth, they have wooden cameras that they, like, they'll make wood mock-ups of camera systems.
Oh, yeah.
And then that's what they use to prototype and build out their different cages and accessories off of.
Do you know what kind of wood they use in wooden camera?
I don't. I think it's a pine.
Okay. Pine? What a weird choice.
It's cheap
it's
and
a
soft.
Cheap wood. Yeah, and soft wood. I think that's why.
But I associate
that's what
that
I think
brand with high quality wood.
Pine?
No, wooden camera, the brand I associate with high quality products / high quality wood.
Yep.
Apparently not.
No.
So is this the, I'm looking at one right now, is this the UFF
that
one?
That is not it. That is their one they announced last year.
Okay.
And that is
out of date.
And as you can see with that
right,
one.
Both rails.
Yeah, but both rails. And that one is also designed that it's for two operators. So it's what I would call a studio follow focus. Mm. So it's set up that you have one knob on the operator side, but you also have it span the other side for the focus puller.
For that side.
This one is only on. It's only designed to be on one side.
Yeah.
So it's usually, like, a lot of times you'd use something like this, like if you're doing a lot of handheld work and, you know, you're pulling your own focus and you'll have that on the left side and you'll have your,
yeah.
the
how much,
hold on the right.
How much does that, the new one go for?
$500.
Okay. So it's less than half the price of this
yes.
one.
Yes.
Pretty good deal.
Yep. Very, very simple.
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah, I said, well worth it. There are, you can totally find follow focus is cheaper than that and you will be paying for a cheaper than that product.
I'm gonna.
I've not currently found any follow focus I have liked that is less than that. It is in that ballpark for less than $500.
You want to get the Airy one, don't you?
I do. Yeah. I would love to get that one, but yeah, that one's like $2,000.
Oh wow.
Or something. And then, you know, for that price, I'm getting my new monitor.
I wonder if I could make a good turnaround if I buy these $500 wooden camera follow focuses and then put on wood. And then resell it.
Or just put on Airy stickers.
Yeah.
Then you can instantly bring up the price by about 40%.
Now you're talking. Great. And then what's the third piece?
So the third thing, and this is what, there was a lot of this. So actually, now that I think about it, maybe this is what you would call this year at NAB, though, to be fair, there wasn't a whole lot of new stuff. But you may call this the year of RGB LEDs. And that's red, green, blue. So LED lights that can cover every color in the spectrum.
Like a sky panel or something.
Yep, exactly. And this year they were showing off more. These were previously announced, but this might be the first time that they're out in public, and that is a company called Quasar. And they made a really cool light, and they basically made, imagine a fluorescent tube with LEDs in it. And the ones they made previously are ones that are just what we would just call bicolor. So they're between like 2600 Kelvin and like 8000 Kelvin. So it just covers that spectrum of white. So you can have your matched white for a scene. And so they have announced their Rainbow Q LEDs, which are the same thing, except they have full RGB color in them, so you can make them any color you want. These are really cool because, one, like, they're not super cheap by any stretch, but because I think, like, the 4-foot tube is like $650 for one 4-foot tube.
Mm.
But if you look at it and consider that you can now get any color you want, it's only as big as a 4-foot fluorescent tube. Add about 4 or 5 inches on, because on one end has the control interface where you get to pick all the colors and whatnot. You have that, and you know, you just run one cable to it and you put it anywhere you want.
You can wrap it on a C-stand or something.
Yep, you put it on a C-stand. You can hide it underneath the, you know, you can hide it above a doorway. You know, tape it to the, you can, you know, these things weigh next to nothing. You can tape it to the wall practically. So
that's pretty cool.
They're just really versatile.
So what's the light output for something like this compared to like a sky panel?
Oh, compared to, like, this is nothing close to a sky panel, but it's close to the output, and I don't know the actual watt output, but of like a Kino Flow fluorescent tube.
So this wouldn't be like any source of key light. This is like your supplement of light somewhere.
Correct. However, you can, like, you know, you could, I think they make a mounting bracket. You could put 8 of these, like you could have a, you know, you could put 8 of them on one block.
Sure.
They have another cool function is, they have a like a leader and follower setting, which like in older, like in program, you know, like a master slave kind of thing, though that probably has gone a little bit out of vogue as political correctness. but like a leader and follower setup where you, because these all have wireless control capabilities, you can control them from a wireless, I believe it's Lumen Radio, which is one of the wireless protocols for wireless lighting. And with it, you can set all of them. So if you have a set of eight, you can set all of them to follow one tube. And then you just need to set that one, and then all of the other ones will change to that.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
So you don't need to go to each one and go, okay, I want to be at, you know, lime green or whatever, and go to everyone. You just set one to lime green, and all the others will follow.
Does that function sort of like, I think it's like an HMI setup where you can cue, you know, lights at certain times?
You mean DMX?
DMX, that's the one.
Yes.
I get my three-letter names mixed up. Yeah, like DMX, where, yeah, you can queue up different sequences of lights. And
yes, you could. Yeah, I think through this app, you can do things like that. Mm-hmm. I have not used this particular app. My background with DMX control comes from theater lighting and how theater systems are set up. And that is becoming a very popular option. You know, if you really look at things, you know, at this time, like if you're at a big Hollywood studio setup, more than likely you have, it's not just a grip and electric crew that just hang the lights and you turn them on. They'll have lights that are DMX controlled, so they're all wired into a switcher, especially in big studios when, you know, you have to put the lighting like, you know, like 60 feet up in the air, so you can't easily go up there to turn one off.
Right.
And so it goes onto a control board and you have a board operator that is controlling everything. And you, I would see things like in Blade Runner 2049, the really awesome scene in Wallace's office with all those moving lights, done probably with a DMX control system, and also probably a moving rig for the light itself, more than likely. A lot of other companies are copying this style, like they're making tube style light because, you know, one, it's a known entity, like it's a traditional size, it's a 4-foot fluorescent tube. We all know what that is. There's a lot of pre-existing brackets and stuff for that. So it's a known entity in that regard, and as I said, it's very convenient to put into small places.
Yeah. So, like, what would then be the difference between, like, say, this, like a Quasar, and then like a Kino Flow? Because there's the same. Are you still the same application or like what?
Yes. So like with Kino Flow, like that's where Kino Flow started by. They had, you know, very expensive fluorescent tubes that were all, you had, you know, basically you had your 5,500 Kelvin ones and your 3,200 Kelvin ones. And that was that. They more recently now they've upgraded and they are creating LED versions, which are like panel LEDs.
Sure.
They did just announce their response to Quasar and also another company that is also making tube style ones called Digital Sputnik. Mm-hmm. They announced the Freestyle, and their take on it though is rather than Quasar and Digital Sputnik where everything you need is in the tube. You know, you have that and you have one power cable that comes off of that and that's it. What Kinoflow decided to do is they have the tube and all that's in the tube is LEDs. So there's no brains, there's no control in any of that. And then you have to run it into a, you know, a big control box that then dictates to what it, to the light what to do. Now, unfortunately, that is in the end, I think it sort of balances out. But if you look at it, like that control box from Kino is like $1,200, and then each tube is like $400 or something. Mm. And you know, you can do up to four tubes into one box, but as I understand it, each tube would have to be the same. You know, you can't make four different colors off of one control box. So it can get expensive compared to Digital Sputnik or Quasar. And so with this, you know, they're looking at that accent lighting, that fill lighting kind of thing. And so that's what they're trying to do, which is what Kino Flow had done for a long time. I think they took a little bit too long to get onto the LED bandwagon. Granted, they are an established brand. People know what Kino Flow is. They trust that brand, and they do make very, very good lights. Mm-hmm. But I think there are some of these benefits of not having to run a second box and everything to the tube makes these so much easier.
Yeah, this seems like it really streamlines the process.
Yeah,
well, even just like easing the bit of about getting different colors into a scene too, instead of just like, I mean, you can still throw up gels if you really want to, but like it's nice that you can just like switch on the fly and get what you want.
And it's nice that the accuracy of those colors is getting up there because, you know, LED lighting, you know, we've all seen it in like theaters and like live, like concert events, like have had LED color changing lights for a long time, for probably about 8 years now, 10 years now, probably even longer. But it's just been a while to get that accuracy of color up to where it has to be in the cinema world. You can't, you know, in theater, like, you know, when I was doing the work, it didn't really matter what light we were using for white that much. Like, you know, you could use a 5500 lamp or a 3200 lamp, we didn't really care. As long as it was consistent, we didn't really care. It doesn't mm-hmm. matter. But in cinema, we do care a lot because that affects your white point.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it's nice to see that that technology is getting up to this yeah. this point of accuracy.
Plus,
now.
It sounds like a great product to use in a music video.
Yes, and which many, many people do. Yeah. They do offer a very interesting look. It's because you get this like neon, especially if you put it in the scene, you get that neon tube look that, you know, previously you needed to specially run KinoFlow tubes and wrap them in gel, or you had to get like full-on neon.
Yeah, God, that would be so much more work to have to do that with yeah. KinoFlows.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Cool. Well, so, you know, despite it not being a kind of a focused NAB with one particular direction, you know, at least people are still trying to, you know, make new products and yep. streamline, you know, some practices. So I yep. like that.
The march of progress continues on.
Yes. It'll be curious. I'll be curious to see if there's a trend next year and where things are headed. Who knows?
Yep.
Maybe VR augmented reality cameras. We'll see.
We already have some of those.
Like cinema augmented reality? I don't know.
But cinema VR has been around.
Oh, yeah. Well, we'll look forward to NAB 2019 then. Well, we'll be right back and talk about working with established IP. So working with established IP, this is something that I've kind of wanted to tackle for a while and is relevant to a kind of a niche. I wasn't even close.
Niche.
It's kind of a.
I need to look at
the. It's kind of a niche market of filmmakers, and it's something I've always been interested in because we all love things like video games, and so combining video game content with film is always fun to do, or other established universes like Star Wars or Star Trek. But the one that I wanted to start off with is our Halo fan film Dawn Under Heaven upcoming mm-hmm. this year. Mm-hmm. And
December 19th.
Look for it in theaters. Some of the hoops.
Theater singular.
Yeah. Or home theater. So some of the hoops we've had to jump through to make that work. And Microsoft has updated their usage rules since we started the project. But back when we started, we weren't allowed to monetize.
Mm-hmm.
We were legally allowed to use their IP. But they have some specific rules that are still in place. For example, when you're posting content online, you have to post their terms of use and as well as link back to the full text on Microsoft's page. And basically their rules are you can use their IP and specifically we're in this instance Halo. You can't use like the word Halo colon your custom name.
Yeah.
Basically their intent, as they explain in their broke down rules, is that they don't want people to confuse your movie or whatever with an official property or that mm-hmm. it's endorsed by Microsoft. And that's essentially it. And it used to be we couldn't make money on YouTube or anything with it. You couldn't monetize videos. And then it changed to where we could. So we started to. But, of course, then YouTube updated their requirements for the partner program. Minimum 1,000 subscribers and 4,000 hours of watch time in the last year.
Yeah. Do you think the change from Microsoft is in response to like Twitch streaming?
It's hard to say, honestly. I mean, that's actually a really good point because with YouTube, you know, I think I feel like it was a little easier to get away with stuff on YouTube.
Yeah.
Like when I first saw Corridor Digital make a short that had Master Chief in it. Mm-hmm. I was like, how can they make money off this? Yeah. This is someone else's IP. But, you know, the waters were a little murky. On Twitch, obviously, you know, you are consistently streaming, like, let's say, Halo or something. Mm-hmm. So yeah. Maybe it's a little easier to catch something like that. But Microsoft, to my knowledge, and this is kind of piggybacking off Bungie's practice, they were really welcoming to people yeah. make content, you know, like Machinima with yeah. Red versus Blue or whatever. So, mm-hmm. you know, I feel like they want to keep that good relationship going and expand on it. Where in contrast to that, you've got Nintendo,
yep.
which... Oh, does that tie into yours?
Are you kind of I do want to make one point because you mentioned Red versus Blue.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
And to people listening, Mick, if you are thinking of doing something involving someone else's IP, as we have done in ways of talking about here, make sure you read their terms of use very yes, carefully. Yeah. For example, because as many of you may know, Red versus Blue, I can buy Red versus Blue merchandise and buy the DVDs, mm-hmm. and they make money off of Red versus Blue. They have a very special, very unique agreement with right. 343 to do that.
That's correct.
They are an outlier in being able to monetize the content they're making based off of the Halo content and Halo games.
It's like, you know, if we wanted to have a Coke bottle in a indie film, maybe Coke would be like, guys, what the hell, take that out. But if you're big enough, then they're like, oh, please put the Coke in your film.
Yep.
So it's like they've reached that beyond the tipping point of, you know, it's, it builds the Halo brand, so they want them to.
Yes, exactly.
Them. So, absolutely. But
I just wanted to make sure we knew that was that's an outlier.
Nintendo, on the other hand, hates when people use their content for anything. But before we even started on Dawn of Heaven, Lee and I considered making a Zelda fan film. Of course, there was, I think it was called, you know, The Legend of Zelda: Hero of Time or something like that. It was a YouTube fan film that, you know, a lot of passion went into. The production value wasn't huge, but this was back in like 2008 when it was hard to make a good looking video for the web.
Yeah.
And they put it online and got taken down, basically shut down from Nintendo.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if Nintendo is super restrictive on that because of their primary audience with their games. Because when I think of Nintendo, I think of primarily kids. Like, obviously, there's plenty of passionate adults who are very into Nintendo games and IPs, but still the target audience is still for everybody and for fans, or like for parents feel comfortable to have their kids play Nintendo games.
Sure.
Whereas Microsoft and specifically Halo, you know, those are mature audiences technically. So I wonder if like Nintendo's just being very particular about trying to protect them being associated with something beyond just kid friendly
the
time.
Yeah, I'm sure that's part of it. Also, they're notorious for wanting absolute control over their brand and how it's perceived. Mm-hmm. So they're very protective of their IP. On the other hand, they also greenlit the Super Mario Brothers movie.
They did.
In the 90s.
And as a result, there has not been another Nintendo film since then.
Yeah.
Curious, I think.
But yeah, I mean, they're. So basically, the IP and the company may vary.
Yeah,
basically.
Uh-huh. And here's another thing. As Wade mentioned, I looked at CBS Paramount, or Viacom technically, and
everything channels back to Viacom.
Yeah,
somehow.
Right. And their stuff with Star Trek. Because for a long time there was a lot of leeway with Star Trek fan things, but then along came a fan film project called Anaxar, Star Trek Anaxar, and this was a crowdfunded fan film. I think it raised like I should look it up. I think they raised like $250,000 or something. They raised a lot of money for this. And it was going to be this a piece about this battle of Anaxar. And they actually hired a bunch of actors from the Star Trek Enterprise TV show. Not the big main characters, but some of the recurring characters or side characters were actually in there to reprise their roles talking about this thing. It was going to be very, very cool.
Wow.
And then CBS, Viacom, Paramount rolled out all these rules about it. For example...
Was this in response to that?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, because it got too big, pretty much, was the issue. And rather than embracing that and, you know, and allowing this to go through in the interest of growing the brand, because there obviously was so many people so interested in this story and whatnot, they imposed all these rules. For example, your total budget and crowdfunding budget cannot be over $50,000. As soon as you hit $50,000, you have to stop.
Wow.
It gets better. You cannot be distributed on any physical media at all.
Hmm.
So no Blu-rays, no DVDs. Here's where it gets difficult, and where, like, for example, if Microsoft had this kind of rule, we would be in a lot of trouble for our film. If you are using any costumes or props that have at all from the universe, if there is an officially licensed replica, you have to use that. You cannot make your own.
Oh my God.
So if you had your own uniforms that you wanted to make, assuming they are based on, they're like ones from these, if you're making up completely new ones, then it doesn't matter. But if like you're wanting to use the uniforms from Star Trek The Next Generation, you would have to buy officially licensed from one of the makers that makes officially licensed costumes.
So for like Dawn or Heaven, I mean, they make Nerf assault rifles. We'd have to use
use the Nerf assault rifles and paint them.
Oh, wow.
It would be so bad.
Especially because they're not full size. They're like, you know, they're mini.
Right. And another thing is videos cannot include profanity, nudity, obscenity, pornography, depictions of drug use, alcohol, tobacco, any harmful or illegal activity, anything that is offensive, fraudulent, inflammatory, libacious, Wait, I bet
you think it's offensive.
No, harmful.
Libelous? Libelous?
Mm.
Libel. It's no libel. Disparaging, sexually explicit, threatening, hateful, or inappropriate content. Now,
oh man, that is a wide
net. That is a very wide net, and especially when they're mentioning this or any material that is offensive, like that is the net that like
covers everything.
They could twist that to make whatever they want.
Exactly.
And again, like as you mentioned, like some of this is wanting to protect the brand, or as Ben was mentioning, you know, the Nintendo's geared towards kids. They don't want people making a Mario Triple X parody because that would be harmful to their brand.
Although I'm sure that's on.
Oh, I'm sure it
Rule
does.
34.
Rule 34. but you know, with this, you know, this is such an oppressive policy that, you know, it, rather than embracing, like Microsoft has done and other companies have done, embracing the people who want to make more content in there and fully realizing that, you know, the people are making this, they know you can't, with some exception, you can't, you know, it's not like you're gonna get rich off of this. You're not gonna sell this and make $1 million, but they want to because they're so passionate about a certain IP in a world that these people have created. And CBS is really doing everything they can to stifle that and make it as annoying as possible. Oh, and the other thing is, it can only be 15 minutes long.
Jesus.
Unless it's a series, in which case there can be no more than 2 episodes that total 30 minutes.
Wow.
Again, taking AMN and Anaxar.
So because
Anaxar planned, I think theirs was going to be a series of like 10 episodes that were going to be like half an hour each.
You know, this it's essentially saying don't even try.
Yes.
And if that's the case, then why even bother with all this? Just say you can't do it.
Yeah.
Don't do anything basic. Because like this is so restrictive that there's just essentially no point to even try. And they should just come out and say, yeah, we're going to be dicks about this and don't make anything on our content.
Yep.
Our
content. I wonder, is it just because like they're so protective of their profits for Star Trek and whatnot? Because like why make that so restrictive?
Do you know what I kind of think? This is my personal thought on it because of the connection of this to Anaxar. I wonder if a small, maybe not the whole part, you know, I'm sure a bunch of it is wanting to protect their IP and to make sure that it is not tarnished in any way. I wonder if there was a little bit of fear that someone else was going to make a series better than they would. Because there was so... Because, again, I'll try and pull this up, how much money Anaxar raised. Because there was a huge following for that.
Yeah. I mean, then, yeah, I think we'd all agree here that, like, they should have just embraced it and been like, all right, if someone can make something better, let's pull them into the fold and try and own what they're doing instead of saying, nope.
Yeah.
Shun. Can't hear you.
So it looks like I think Anaxar raised about $100,000. I mean, they were actually sued too by Paramount.
Oh, wow.
And actually, J.J. Abrams actually came out and said that Paramount should not sue Anaxar. Mm. And so then they didn't. And then they did again.
Damn.
But yeah, I wonder if it's something like that. I wonder if it's like this fear of someone else having something that people like more than what they put out. Because, like, for example, for Enterprise, Enterprise was one of the poorest received of the Star Trek series. Their first couple seasons started out pretty interesting, and then it sort of went downhill after that. And so I wonder if they know, like, this, like, people are trying, like, oh, look, you can do, because this, again, this film, because it was using some of the same cast, it takes place during the time that Enterprise was, like, during that time period. And I think they're wondering, like, oh, someone's going to make something and show that it actually could have been good, and they're actually going to sort of snub us and show us up what is possible.
So it's interesting because it's, like, the exact opposite of, like, what Star Wars is like. Because, like, when you're, like, considering doing anything via Star Wars, like your fan film or whatever, it's almost entirely embraced. Like, even Lucasfilm or, like Star Wars, they have their own annual fan film contest.
Yeah, bring us through the Star
and
Wars.
And isn't it what that contest is like? That's technically the only way you're supposed to do it. Like, if it's submitted through the contest, then it's okay.
To say it's the only way you can do it, I would say is incorrect because there's proof otherwise. Just because there's plenty of people who do fan films who only release to YouTube or whatnot and don't go through that process. Maybe it makes it perhaps a little bit more official, if anything, because it is a contest. You can push it through and you can win things and you can get your content shown on StarWars.com and featured and whatnot, which is cool. Because that level of I don't know the correct verbiage for it, but like that is a relatively recent thing and hasn't really existed before, where it's like 10 years ago or what have you. It's just kind of like all whatever kind of fan film thing you find is either on like StarWarsFanFilms.com or like on like just anywhere. Like, no, there's no, there was no centralized place for it. But the rule was almost always just that you can't make money off of it, and that's just the flat thing. Like, you can call it Star Wars, you can call it whatever. You can have your opening crawl, you can have characters can have like other actors come in. I don't think you can have like Mark Hamill come in and sign on for like a fan film. They probably messes with their own contract, I'm sure.
Huh. Oh yeah, that's another thing, is you can't pay anyone at all. And it all has to be amateurs and for CBS.
Oh, for the Star Trek?
It has to be amateurs. Yeah. I think they actually use that wordage in their amateurs.
Mm, yeah.
Well, so if you got like a real actor.
That kind of falls in line and makes sense with their policy. But for the Star Wars thing, I mean, I kind of like that because it seems like they understand that, yeah, people are going to make fan films and we'd want to try and funnel that into, you know.
Sure. Well, I think when you look at it, the success of Star Wars as a cultural pop phenomenon, like it's been lifted up solely by its fans, right? Like, it's, you have generations of fans of Star Wars. It's like it's just built into that culture. So yeah. I feel like if you did anything to hamper that, I think you would get hurt to some degree.
Yeah, which is weird because I feel like Star Trek is largely the same, where it's been propped up by its community and fans.
It was the community that saved Star Trek, because when Star Trek, the original series, first came out, it went for the 3 seasons and no one really cared. It wasn't until reruns, and people wanted the reruns, that it actually became super popular. Mm. Even, you know, if not for the fans demanding to be able to see it again, you know, maybe Star Trek would have died.
Sure.
You know, 40 years ago.
Yeah.
The interesting thing has been ever since Disney bought the Star Wars IP, it's always been kind of like, well, what's going to happen now with fan films? Because Disney in the past has always been very restrictive upon their own intellectual property, specifically with Mickey Mouse.
Yeah.
And the whole copyright.
Yeah. You know, so are they just going to indefinitely keep like recopywriting?
They're going to keep it's not, they're not going to keep recopywriting. They're going to continue to lobby Congress every, I don't know how often it comes up.
But they're trying to change the law
I won't go into too much detail on this because it's not our discussion, but originally copyright, the idea with copyright being is that it's protecting the author's revenue from the, and so originally I think it was like 10 years or 15 years. 50 years? Okay. So, but it was at a time when people didn't live as long and whatnot. So the idea being is that if you wrote something, you created something, you were owed all the rights and the profit from that for basically as long as you lived, basically. Mm-hmm. And then it became the death of the author, specifically the death. So then it, you know, that was sort of a fluctuation. Then it became like the death plus 10 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Then it became death plus 20 years. And at this point it kept going, and now it's like the death plus 70 years.
Yeah.
And we are, I think, actually rapidly approaching Walt Disney's death
and Mickey
plus
Mouse
70
becoming
years.
Public domain.
Yep.
So, but they're just going to keep
lobbying it because they will never want anyone else to have control. It's worth too much money.
It's the death plus 575
yep,
years.
Exactly. Yeah. They're going to continue to push that. And there's a very good video on it by CGP Grey talking about how, you know, people nowadays we're losing out. Because content is not going into the public domain. You know, it's like, you know, you go out right now, you record, film your take on a Grimm's fairy tale. You can do that. It's a Grimm's fairy tale. It's, I don't know, 100 years old. I don't know.
Yeah, it's a long time. Yeah.
You know, you can do that. But it's like, but you know, as of probably about, you know, at this point, maybe about 80, 90 years ago, 100 years ago or something, it stopped. Stuff stopped coming into the public domain that you can mess with. You know, there would have been a time when we would have been able to see Star Wars and we could make our Star Wars anything and there'd be no rules on it because it's in the public domain.
Yeah.
And now that's not happening.
Yeah. That's a good point. That may be something we can look at a later
episode. Yeah, that would be an interesting talk.
But that's really fascinating. And you know, I think a lot of people would hope that that would change, but you know, the powers that be, in Disney included, you know, maybe want to,
yeah, when you have the lobbying money of Disney, there's
right,
very
but
little that can
they
be
are making the exception for Star Wars, which is
yeah,
interesting.
Because it's, I think it's because they're taking what's the word, they're stewards of Star Wars now,
right,
versus
not the creators.
Do you think that has partially to do with, unlike most other Disney content, there has been a history of fan films since before they were owned by Disney?
I would say that's, I mean, maybe something that would be something that would be something that Disney maybe would want to change in the future, but because there's already such an established base for fan created content for Star Wars, I would say that it's a strategic move on Disney's part to not fuck with it. Mm. You know, it's just, just like embrace people wanting to make their own little like lightsaber film when they were a kid. Like, hell, like most of the filmmakers that I know at some point probably made some sort of Star Wars fan filmy thing or like wanted to when they were growing up. Like, that's like a huge inspiration for people. Mm-hmm. And so why would you necessarily want to stop that from happening?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So.
Well, that's two very interesting and contrasting takes from the Star Trek Star Wars angle. I like that a lot. So I know at least one of these properties, Halo, was in the movie we're about to talk about, Ready Player One.
Yep. Yeah. Couple Master Chiefs. Arguably is the greatest triumph of combining IPs in history.
Which which we will talk about right after this. All right, the notes have been collected. David's got his pages of notes here, which I should have written down, but the only way I could have done it is use my phone in the theater. I didn't want to do that.
Oh, I did this morning. I went back through my, because Katie and I went to see the movie with my wife.
We should start having some sort of spreadsheet to keep track of how many pages of notes you make for each movie we talk about.
Ooh. Well, it's funny. We used to do about my pages of note in general. For NAB, I had 38 pages of notes on NAB that. Gear.
But anyway, so Ready Player One. This is Spielberg's latest endeavor. He directed and produced?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Well, so here we are.
Ready Player One, and the answer is no.
The answer,
no.
Okay, let's take
player one is not ready.
Let's
no.
Let's try player two. See if that's
the sequel.
Yeah,
it's about their kid.
So
spoiler alert.
So just first impressions.
No,
no. We got to know, Ben.
No.
I want to err on the side of no.
Okay.
And I think your way.
I tried to hold back, but I had to tweet/text after I got out of the theater.
Yeah, it was very strong.
We both got
fucking hated this movie. It was, I've never walked out of a movie before, and I almost did. I went with my girlfriend. She wouldn't let me. Mm. But yeah, I just could not stand this movie from the very opening scene. When they chose arguably the worst Van Halen song to start with, Jump.
Yeah. Also, I forgot what I was going to say.
Okay, but...
Oh, no, I was going to agree with you that the first, like, it started off, like, very serious, and all of a sudden, like, it just kind of, like, went to black, and then they just, like, showed the title, and then went back right into it. It was all very...
Every decision they made for the opening scene was awful.
Yeah.
Oh, I remember. Also, for the record, has anyone here read the book? I have not read it.
No.
Okay, so we are all... Because I know there was... hearing
about
the reviews,
the book's better.
That's what I've heard.
Yeah. But...
And I can totally see
But with
why.
The opening scene, not only did they choose just a weird song that didn't really fit, they made... Almost the entire full song play, even after dialogue scenes started happening. Yep.
On the note of that opening, sorry, yes. You know, finish your thought. I'm cutting you off.
Well, no, I was just gonna add that not only was it a bad song choice, but they basically filled that first 5 minutes with exposition.
Yes,
and voiceover. Voiceover exposition, the worst kind.
And I'm about to. That's what I was gonna talk about.
Yeah.
Because as I think I've mentioned on other podcasts, with very rare exception, I feel like voiceover. Exposition in the beginning, or it is the sign of poor storytelling.
Yes, absolutely.
Because it doesn't give the audience their due credit for what they can process and understand.
Yeah.
Like I can think of some rare exceptions. One of them, this might also come from just bias towards it, but for like Lord of the Rings, there's the opening dialogue. But again, like they're not spelling everything out for you in it. They're giving you reference,
right.
And then they show you in visual form. Which they did in this movie. They do it and they talk about like nobody goes out anymore, like everyone's in the thing. And as they're showing people in the game, it's like you don't need to tell me that.
Yeah.
I can see, you're showing it to me.
Right.
It's all right there.
Maybe in test audiences it wasn't clear enough.
Well, those test audiences were idiots and I should be in those test audiences.
The test audiences were probably bored 12-year-olds.
Mm-hmm.
Who weren't paying attention. Which would
be a terrible thing, because that's not the demographic either. Because they don't know on half the IPs.
Yeah, that's the thing. I wanted to save this note till later, but I'll just make the point now. I don't think this film has a market audience. It's either... It's a niche lich audience of of 40-year-old hyper gamers who like are super plugged in still to 80s culture and would love something like this. But for normal people who grew up in the 80s, they don't really care about movies like this, and kids don't give a shit about these 80s references, and it's so boring.
Oddly enough, I think the three of us actually land in their target market, though, because we are active gamers, and we are filmmakers.
Yeah.
So we know, like, anything that they directly referenced, I think I knew what it was. I may not have played it, but I knew it.
But none of the references, hardly any of the references, a negligible amount, played into the story itself.
It's true.
It was pointless. 95% of the references just were complete shit and throwaway and had no bearing on the story, so it might have been not been in there.
I think my issue with the movie, and this it's more or less,
I have three pages.
Well, I was trying, I mean, I tried to wrap it up all into like one single sentence, and it was more or less just like, this is a very, it's a tired story with a mediocre execution that really only is lifted up by its nostalgia and member berries. Yeah. Like if you took out all of that nostalgia, it would be a piss poor movie.
I would actually recommend this movie if member berries were in it. Yeah, that would make it but yeah, I think that hits
One interesting thing, since we're on the beginning. In the beginning, there's that fancy treadmill that he's running on. Mm-hmm. That's a real treadmill. That actually exists. This company makes a, like, you can't run on it yet, I don't think, but you can walk briskly on a treadmill that does have two axes, mm-hmm. and because it has two different axes of treadmill motion, you can move in any direction.
On that
really
note,
cool.
I was really bothered by
all the people in real life doing the VR stuff and walking around real life.
Yeah,
yes,
that was really fun. The people next to a street in the VR. No, they clearly made an effort to make the text seem realistic, and yet it's completely implausible. For example, when anyone gets in a car or sits on a motorcycle, they're not able to sit on any. They're still on the treadmill. Yeah.
Yep.
So how were they able to move their body like that?
I saw a review on like Wired or something, and that one of the comments was like, "Try as he might, even Steven Spielberg can't make VR cool to watch."
Right.
Like, you know, like we've all played VR. You've seen me play VR. Yeah. It's like, that's not a cool. I don't look cool.
Yeah.
When I'm like with a blinders, like with a blast shield, how am I supposed to fight?
Yeah. VR
like,
never looks
waving
cool.
Around, like it, and like, but that's okay. Like, because being in VR is the cool thing, of course. But like the other thing of like how, like, it seems that as a way, I think, of trying to bridge that, it seems that they're all more like augmented reality glasses rather than as we currently have, where it's a full on screen. Mm-hmm. Because you can see people's eyes through it, but they can't see through it, you know? So it doesn't make any sense.
You know, that text ridiculous. But I think that's honestly, it's a legitimate critique of this movie, but it's probably one of the lesser things I would focus on.
Yeah,
right now.
That's true.
Because, like, at the heart, the reason why it didn't work for me, a lot of reasons, but it comes down to the story being just a complete mess.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically the story, the concept of Willy Wonka.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And it's told,
but it's only the beginning of Willy Wonka. It's the search for the golden ticket.
Well, but it also has, you know, the very end also plays into, you know, Charlie at the end, who is like,
who gets everything at the end?
Who gets everything, true. But also is just like,
so
you know,
it's as if they took the
too.
Beginning search of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, put it, but set it inside the factory for the search. With the same money.
No, I think it's pretty much Willy Wonka, because like you get your main character who by luck gets into the game and gets into the running, and is surrounded by people who are trying to all find the same thing, all fail because they just missed the moral of the story.
Okay, not only did they fail, I thought that none of these the puzzles were particularly clever.
No, they
were. They were all very obvious. Yeah. If like from all these people that allegedly spent all their time learning everything about,
I'm surprised
Holloway,
they didn't figure it out sooner.
And like, and so the thing that Katie pointed out is like, we have all played games that have been around for a while, or games we have played many, many times. There comes a point when you start dicking around,
mm-hmm.
you do,
oh, and
you
that
do
point
dumb
comes
stuff
quick, yes. Especially if you're looking for a secret.
Yes. And
if
nobody went backwards, in 4 years,
that'd be the first
not a
thing
single fucking person
tried.
Went backwards.
Yeah,
no.
And also, that kind of touches on a bigger point I want to raise, is that you got the big conglomerate corporation, IOI,
the evil,
which has an army of people trying to find this Easter egg. They wouldn't be playing the game trying to like find it. They would be hacking the shit out of it, and they'd find it within the first day.
Yeah.
Like, seriously, you think about Destiny Raid, mm-hmm. right? As hard as those are, they're solved within a matter of hours.
You unplug your Ethernet cord at Crota to get them to stop moving and you put it back in. Yeah.
No, like, especially if we're talking about, you know, 25, 30 years in the future, this is something that companies would figure out within hours. I mean, it wouldn't even be fair.
Yeah.
But they're trying to play the game like idiots.
Yep. And also, I was very confused about what IOI's abilities were,
mm-hmm.
because at times it seemed like IOI was making in-game content for the game. It almost like there seemed like there were certain weapons and things that it wasn't clear to me, but like it seemed like they were IOI things. And at the very least, IOI makes external hardware for the game, so they would have had some in to the software.
That's a good point.
Because they would have to make a way of making their the weird lap dance scene. Can we can I point out how weird that was?
Oh, the opening with the pole dance?
No, with the chick, with Artemis, when they're floating.
Oh yeah.
When she's like
can you feel all this?
Can you feel this? And then after that she gets all indignant that he likes her.
Yeah.
So
that in that part, he's wearing the full tactile suit, which is a pretty neat idea, but
if
someone punches you, it's like, oh, well, I guess I'm vulnerable now in this world.
Yeah. Yep. It hurts. And also, as we see someone's glowing crotch later on.
So when, basically, to my understanding, the movements your real body makes, that is reflective in the Oasis. So when you're doing a hand-to-hand fight, you have to be able to make all those movements, right?
Yeah.
But if someone punches you, there's no feedback response. Like, you would not fly backwards.
Right. You would feel it, but you wouldn't fly from it.
Yeah. And so when he did, at the very end when he was fighting the dude, the big corporate bad boss, who's also his own henchman, he does the backflip kick. Did he actually do that in that small van that he was doing?
Yeah, of course he did. Duh.
Yeah, I think it's very strange. I feel like most of this movie was just kind of like, oh, this sounds cool, let's do it.
Yeah. Essentially, yeah.
I think, if anything, I went into this movie with very little expectations. So I think for the most part, I kind of enjoyed it. Yeah. Because I just, I wasn't expecting any sort of incredible piece from Spielberg or anything like that. I just figured it was going to be shot mediocrely well for what it was. And then it was going to be... it's just how many references can I see, and then what's going to be my favorite at the end?
It's such a shame though, because I feel like it could have been really good.
Probably, yeah.
It could have been really good. What you could say about anything?
So that kind of makes me want to touch on things I liked about the film. I liked the
Wait, I don't have any pages of that.
what's the guy who created the Oasis?
Holloway.
Holloway. I liked the guy who played Holloway.
I thought he did that character justice.
I would actually agree. Actually, that is a note I have in here. And I thought that the fact that he did does seem to have, in my opinion, some kind of social disorder or mental illness of some kind that obviously impaired his.
It was Asperger's.
Yeah, on the spectrum. Yeah. And I'm not a doctor. I can't diagnose. Yeah. But he seemed to have some of that. Yeah. I thought that was really cool. Yeah. I thought that was a good thing to.
But
have.
But also, by far the most interesting part of the story was how he as a dead character, we were looking back at his past and we could see his character flaws, what he regretted, and little things about how he wished his life had gone differently. We should have focused more on that in the story.
Yes.
That would have been really cool.
Yep.
But instead it's this, the main character is completely bland.
More than completely.
I was surprised with actually how much CGI was in this film. And I want to quantify that
a little bit.
You
mean the avatars?
Yeah, because I expected CGI Fun Fest, for sure. But I was not expecting...
I'm glad that's catching on.
Yeah, CGI Fun Fest.
Yeah, the avatars you thought would have been the actual
people. Yeah, there was full scenes where there was not action happening that were done in full CGI. With that, I was not expecting that. And I thought, in some respect, that was cool, especially when you have your focus, your world is in CGI and they start watching... live action stuff. I thought that was interesting too.
It's on that note, and I knew that was happening because there was an interview with the cinematographer who I'm forgetting his name, and I feel bad about that. But he said that he basically only shot 30% of this movie because most of it was CG. And I think one of the first times ever, it's like, it makes sense that most of it is CG. From a storytelling standpoint, when you're in a video game and if you have these characters that can be anything or you can make yourself look whatever you want, it makes sense that the actor is not a live action plane of their avatar.
Do you have a DP for CGI?
Well, that's what it was interesting. This article said that he didn't do anything for it.
Well, I understand that he didn't do anything for it, but I wonder, when you're crafting these full scenes, do you have a person who is like, okay, we want to look at this from this sort of lens?
Yeah.
Because there's a couple of times where they pulled focus, and you could tell from the breathing of the lens and everything that stuff was changing when they were mixing between the live action shots and the CGI shots, and I wasn't exactly sure. If anything, from a technical standpoint, I kind of want to go back and just see individual scenes and see how they were doing it. I don't know.
I would theorize that falls under the VFX supervisor department.
Probably in close work with Spielberg.
Yeah,
I think would be picking some of that.
But yeah, I mean, God, just so much My brain's clogged right now. What's next on your notes, David?
Let me see. Here's a general one. So the composer for this was Alan Silverstein.
Really?
Yes. Who
else is
that surprising?
He's Back to the Future.
That's surprising because I love his work.
I knew immediately because he leaned so heavily on Back to the Future. Like, you heard the Back to the Future twinkles. Mm-hmm. And all sorts of things. The themes were coming through. And I know, the main character's car is the Back to the Future car. I understand that.
Which, by the way, can I just say, it's BS that he's the only person who'd have the DeLorean. The DeLorean would be everywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, come on. If you can have whatever you want in the Oasis.
I was very surprised.
Yeah. And that it never flew. Anyway.
I was surprised they didn't have light cycles. How did no one have a light cycle in...
That's what I thought. Yeah, exactly. That's what I thought Artemis might have been going for with her bike. But
yeah. I feel like it was that they were in... Well, actually, I think it was more like the Akira.
Yeah,
From the anime Akira.
That DLC was too
expensive. Yeah, I did not care for the soundtrack at all. I think he was leaning far too heavily on the themes from Back to the Future.
Yeah.
And which was, again, maybe the member berry sense makes sense, but it's silly. Like, if you're going to do that, like, maybe do homages to more of the IP that you have.
Oh, totally.
In it, make it a medley of it, and it could, like, it'd be so interesting if you heard a mashup between, like, the Halo 2, like, guitar and Back to the Future. Like, you could have some really interesting music.
I would have much preferred a full-on mashup of soundtrack because it seemed just, like, so blah to me. The only part I actually remember of the soundtrack was the part that bothered me, which is when the first flashback scene, memory scene of Holloway. When main character is trying to get his first clue, Wade Watts, which is a cool name for characters. The first Wade, I think, has ever been a main character.
Main character, yes, but not the first Wade.
It's
you're forgetting GTA 5.
We won't bring that one up. So it's this, really kind of, sad scene about how he doesn't want to make any more rules, and it's just like over the top sad, bells or whatever. I'm just like, oh god, they hit it right away. I love Alan Silvestri's work. It's weird that
There's a spoiler, and probably at this point I'm probably gonna get
just
into
don't
more spoilers.
Worry about spoilers. Yep.
Well, what we gotta do
the movie itself is just
so in the very end spoilers. They have a cameo in by not really cameo, has been in previously, but yeah, I have Simon Pegg character as I don't remember what the guy's name, I don't care. The partner to Holloway, Ogden Wernstrom. Sorry, that's a Futurama joke.
They just called him Og.
Yeah. So he shows up at the end, and it is revealed that he is the curator. So he is the
which we assume is an AI.
Yes. Yeah. Which for this museum, after Holloway died, this sort of museum appeared that was everything from Holloway's life that he cataloged and wrote down.
Used his clues.
And I have to say, bullshit.
Right.
There is no way that one person could be a 24/7 curator.
Yeah, so
for
he's just logged
digital
in.
Digital world.
He's logged in at all times.
And having to, and like, there's no way that, so you're making, so you have this digital world that has almost endless possibilities, and you're going to have one NPC that players can interact with to search this library.
Yeah, he'd be swarmed by thousands and thousands of people per day.
At the height of it, there could be millions would be cramming into that library to try and learn.
Like, hey, if you get this Easter egg, you get $500 billion, like the world's biggest fortune.
Yeah,
Simon Pegg's not going to be hanging out by himself at the museum.
Go ahead.
I have a
continuing thought. So as we can see, for many of these puzzles, the keys to these puzzles are in Holloway's life. Holloway's life. Which
oh,
is
God,
a
that's right? Go ahead.
Which apparently from what I've heard, like the book and the movie share only like the names of characters in common. Like the plot actually diverges quite largely.
Yeah.
So I don't know what the book is like, and in the certain sense, like yes, that's a clever way of doing having to know this person's actual personal life, not his video game life, but his personal life, to learn these things. What annoyed me. It was mainly the end one. So at the very end, he gets into the door and then he has to sign that contract.
Yeah.
And he's like, no, this is the contract that you made, Og sign.
Yeah.
That signed over his share of the company. But like many detective novels, there's no way the audience could know that.
Mm-hmm.
That was a scene that even if you had hinted at it, even if you had shown in the background of they were walking through the library, you saw that scene in the background and it maybe just lingered on it for a second longer, like some way that the audience could make that connection themselves.
Right.
And not have it be, no, I know this because I must have watched this 100 years ago and the audience never knew it. It was a terrible waste of a moment.
I think that that's a symptom of a larger issue in much of the more mainstream, like either movies or even video games too, is that the uses of stuff that happens in plot is too suggestive of what is going to happen in the future.
Yeah.
The first opening, you can almost basically tell how this entire movie is going to go.
Yep.
And like the either like staying on a scene for a little bit too long or having like that one line, everything is too suggestive. It's like we're gonna have this line so we could substantiate this thing happening in the future.
Right.
Like when they're going through after he gets the first clue and he gets this slew of money and he's like gonna go like spending it all.
Oh yeah, that was
look
really
at all the
bad
things that he buys. Like they substantiate the holy hand grenade. Well, I bet that's gonna come back in the future.
Chekhov's gun.
The one big cataclysm or whatever like that. The one big bomb that kills off everybody. Yeah, that's Chekhov's definitely gun. Gonna come back. Yeah, it's just like
right. No, you're totally right.
Everything's way too predictive.
That's you're totally right. And I think the film that to me did that by far the worst is Van Helsing with
Hugh
Jackman.
Mm. Yeah.
Every single thing is like in the very beginning, like, you have a mysterious past and, you know, and there's this tapestry with a torn corner. No one knows what happened to the, it's like, yep, all right, this is going to come in handy at just the right time.
Yep.
Yeah.
And another thing coming at the ending. At the end, Mr. Big Bad CEO apparently goes off his rocker enough to want to kill a 16-year-old or whatever, mm-hmm. because that makes sense. So he goes off. He shows up in the stacks. He walks into the stacks, and then this lady comes up and says, "We know what you did here."
Yeah, what the fuck?
Don't, you know, walk away. And he and everyone crowds around him, and then he pulls a gun, and then everyone gets out of his way.
And he doesn't even point it at anybody. He just points it up.
And everyone gets out of his way. So every person in the stacks is an asshole. The fact that not a single person, you have the idea, because you're in VR, you know that what's going down. You know, because they're all in that world. You know this crazy asshole is likely coming here to shoot a 16-year-old kid.
Mm-hmm.
And not a single person is stopping him.
Yeah, and they...
Every single person in the stacks of Columbus, in the future, not anyone currently listening in Columbus, I'm sure you're lovely people, but your future generations, all assholes.
And as he was walking forward, still not pointing the gun at anybody, they all just split like the Red Sea.
He was terrible. They
By the way,
all terrible people.
On the topic of the stacks, when when they blow up that whole apartment, like section of apartments or whatever they were, and
you would think they would use unbranded drones to drop off those bombs.
That's true.
No, and also clearly YOY. No, so I thought it was his mom. His aunt dies with the asshole boyfriend, and honestly, the next time we see the main character, he does not give a shit.
No, he doesn't give a shit.
And
no.
He's like, let's have this romantic scene, baby.
Yeah. And also, can I ask real quick on the drones? I don't think from a physics standpoint, I don't think a tricopter drone works.
They exist.
Well, I know they do, but I feel like from a simplicity standpoint, a quadcopter can move more easily in the main two axes, forward, backward, left, and right. It's a simpler setup than three because of where the motors are placed. Like going sideways on three would be more difficult.
Yeah, but it looks cool, man.
Yeah, I know. Okay, anyway, but go
he's
on.
Got it,
Ben,
he's got
Ben.
It. I am looking forward to all of the memes that are coming forward with this CEO dude and crossing it over with Rogue One because he also plays Krennic, right, in Rogue One?
Yes, he does.
God,
yes, he does.
So there's going to be so many sequel memes. It's going to be excellent.
Yeah, we were this close.
He was essentially the same character in both movies, and that really bugged me.
That's true. So I guess one thing I feel like we should touch on is, if you have a favorite reference, what was it?
No.
Did you not have a favorite reference?
No.
Really?
I don't want to see this movie again.
I want to go back just to see. I want to watch it again for the sole purpose of just seeing how, like, all the references to see, like, what
that's what they're banking
in.
On. They don't care if it's a good movie. They want you to go back to see the references.
That's not true. I may see because I may want to see if I can find a Rooster Teeth, because in theory Rooster Teeth had the ruby and the gun were in it, could have been in it.
I was thoroughly surprised, happily surprised about there being a Gundam reference.
That was pretty cool.
Yeah, I was like pretty. I was.
And he jumped off Serenity, didn't he?
Yeah,
he jumped off Serenity.
Which okay, you know, cool. But again, it's like the it's like watching a toddler with action figures. Like, and then he's and then Gundam, yeah, and then smash them together. It's
the whole
like,
ending of the movie was just took so long for it to happen.
It would not fucking end.
And also,
I was like, end
and,
already.
And on that note, so at the very end, the main character makes a what he thinks is an impassioned plea to the players and is not. It was a terrible speech, yeah. Terribly executed. What he thought was an impassioned plea to the players, and then they all show up. One, I thought that speech was terrible.
It was.
And he like, I gave no shit.
He totally changed the tone of voice. He's like, I want to come in front of you today to talk about the Oasis.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
It's a terrible speech. But what made it all the worse is because we have no frame of reference to an average Joe player.
Mm-hmm.
Not any of the main characters who are all extraordinary. You have Artemis, who's like the Gunter Hunter or whatever, and you have his H, who is this whiz, and you know you have the Asian stereotypes.
Asian stereotype one, Asian stereotype
yep.
two.
So you have those people. So you have which I would call in the sentence extraordinary because they are supporting characters, so they have unique traits. You have no reference to the experience of the average Joe player, mm-hmm. So in my opinion, I have no reason to care if they come or not
right.
to that ending battle because right. I don't like what is their experience mm-hmm. of it. And yeah, I thought that was a huge like that whole ending was just worth it. And then it just became the CGI fun festiest of the CGI fun fests
yeah.
of just like IP explosion.
I mean,
everywhere.
So during that time, I think that was around the time that Artemis in real life was trying to disable the bomb.
Yeah, who I have to say is a much more interesting character than the main.
Yeah, oh, totally. Mm-hmm. Everyone in this movie.
The fact that like that she had no development other than like your dad was killed or basically died in one of these loyalty centers.
Yeah, they just that was like a throwaway moment. They just she blew it out.
And we don't so, go into that.
So during that time, she's trying to disable the bomb. I think I blacked out during that. Like I just
it didn't matter.
I don't remember anything that happened. I just my brain shut off during that scene.
Yeah.
It was cutting back and forth between this apocalyptic just CGI.
Fuck fest,
and Artemis trying to disable the bomb. It was just a complete schlocky editing mess. And real quick, because we blew right past it, so I wanted to mention that in order to unlock the Easter egg, you have to know everything about Holloway's life, right?
Yes.
But they also say you need to know everything about 80s pop culture.
Yes.
Which is it? Because it's clearly not 80s pop culture because all the keys are found within moments of his life that have nothing to do with 80s pop culture except for
the last one.
Adventure.
Yeah, except for the very last one.
But like besides that, I feel like it kind of drops the floor out from the premise of the Oasis because it's all supposed to be about 80s pop culture. But if it doesn't matter because it's about Holloway's life instead of, you know, the 80s, it's like, okay, why are we going back to the 80s for no other reason than to just get the audience to come in and see the references.
I feel like maybe it's just worth reading the book just because this movie didn't I want to read the book just to see if it redeems the story.
Well, it won't because
it's a different story.
Yeah. Which as I said, like I think I made this actually on a very early podcast. I don't remember if it was this one or one of the one of our older podcasts where we saw Ender's Game.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the first movie where I made the conscious choice of I will not judge a movie based on the book. I need to judge a movie based on the movie because it's unfair of me. This is my opinion on it. It is unfair of me to make the comparison because now having been in the industry and whatnot, I know you can't make a word-for-word recreation of a book in a movie. It can't happen. There's too much there. There's things that don't go over well on screen. Like, you know, internal monologue works great in a book. Very rarely does it work and look good in a movie.
Right.
So I understand that it's not a fair comparison. I am curious to read it or maybe even listen to it because apparently there's an audiobook version that's done by Will Wheaton from Star Trek Next Generation that apparently is really, really good. I do want to read it just to see what everybody loved because it was like a New York Times bestseller for like 30 weeks or something.
Yeah, although I think I read an article about how the time and the place of its release made a big difference because the author came out with a sequel in 2015.
There's a sequel?
Not a sequel.
Oh.
Another book that was essentially a very similar story maybe premise, I believe. And it just bombed, basically. It just did not get the same reception. And I think it was a different sort of, it was pre-Gamergate, you know?
Sure.
And so it was, you know, it was released in a different time. I think a lot of the feedback I've heard from people who like the movie do so because they liked the book and enjoyed the book and in their minds saw a pretty good attempt to put it on the screen.
See, that's not what I have heard at all.
Okay.
I have only heard that the comparison I have heard everywhere from people who have seen the movie and read the book and from reviews has been, if you liked the book, you will hate the movie. Hmm. If you never read the book, you will like the movie. Is what I have heard.
But that's the opposite of our experience.
Yes. Well, I think just because we come from a different perspective of watching the movie. I mean, we're coming as professionals in the industry. We're trying to like put it through the paces.
I don't think that's necessary, though.
No, I don't think it's necessary, but I feel like most people nowadays go to a movie theater to be entertained. This movie was made for entertainment.
I don't think it's entertaining at all, though. And there were a bunch of kids behind me in the theater. They were bored as fuck. They were not paying attention to the movie because it's a boring movie.
Terrible characters.
It is. Like, if you take the action scenes, they're boring action scenes.
Yeah.
Seriously. Like, action scenes can be done well that draw out tension that
it also didn't help in the action. There's no stakes.
It's like, there are no stakes.
It's like, okay, you die, so you lose your gear and your coin. So you can, like, you just respawn.
They try so hard to make the Oasis relevant to real life stakes, and it falls flat.
What they were trying to allude to is that, like, you put your own money into the game, and so when you lose all your shit, you actually lose all the money that you invested in the game.
Yeah.
So I feel like that's where they tried to, like, put their stakes into it.
And it didn't work.
No.
It didn't work at all.
But yeah, I mean,
and then like, oh, look at that ending. Oh, look, we're gonna close the Oasis twice a week. Wow,
what if
real progressive?
If everyone's like lives in it, basically, what if it's your job? Okay, like mandatory 2 days off a week where you can't do anything to make money. Yeah, the whole ending where he's like, remember, kids, like.
Reality is the only thing that's real.
And then, where he's
what
like,
a profoundly,
he's, like in, the, he's in the chair, he's got his hot trophy chick on his knee, and he's just like making out with her. He's like, yeah, like,
yeah,
this is what you can aspire to one day.
Yeah.
Someone brought up a really good point, which I think is very valid, that when Artemis was like, you don't want to meet me in real life, you'd be disappointed. Like, this isn't my real body. They had an opportunity to make it someone who's not represented in a positive light on screen, like someone who's maybe a little overweight or unattractive and, you know, a glaring feature.
Yep.
But it's totally a smoking hot chick with a mark on her face.
Yeah. Yep.
With a birthmark. And it's like, that is not at all what.
If only H made the joke early on when they're dealing with it. It's like, you know, it could be like an overweight dude named Chuck. Like, oh my gosh, if it was an overweight dude named Chuck, I would have been so happy.
Sure.
If Artemis was an overweight dude named Chuck, that would have been so good.
Well, to me, that whole line was just another one of those substantiating lines. Okay, well, H is going to be this person.
Foreshadowing line.
Yeah, that she...
A woman who clearly has a voice modulator on.
Yeah.
And just like H's mannerisms, too. Very feminine, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's just like, oh, this is going to come into play later.
Yep.
Red Letter Media had a great review of this on their Half in the Bag show where...
Oh, it already came out.
Yeah. Oh, it's been out for a while.
Where Rich said that... there's a cartoon from the early 2000s.
Danny Phantom. Yep, I've seen the beginning of the review.
Yeah, that essentially, Ready Player One took the plot up.
Yeah.
They're stuck in a virtual world, and they have to find
seven silver keys.
But they're actual keys, and it's just like, oh, well, all right, same plot.
And the same thing, there's like the big, like this character named Chaotch, this big, like, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger robot thing, and it's a girl.
Yeah.
Like, oh, wow, what real original people.
Huh. Mm.
So, God, this is just like a smorgasbord of things to talk about in this movie. You asked about our favorite references. I think my favorite reference was, just because I wasn't expecting it, I thought it was cool to see a bunch of Master Chief Spartans in the final battle.
I think my
granted, I would have appreciated a Bungie Master Chief model instead of the 343.
Yep.
I could just feel the hand of Microsoft, like, we've got to put Master Chief in there, get that recognition.
I think my favorite reference comes at the very end of the film. At the very end, the whole screen goes to black for a moment, and then these words start coming up on screen. And I think they're making reference to a thing in many movies called credits, and it means the movie's over. And I think that's great.
Yeah, the credits. No, we usually, all three of us usually sit through the credits of movies. Yep. Not this time.
Oh, you didn't sit.
Oh,
didn't
I stayed.
Wait. I
walked the fuck out.
I make no exception for that. I don't care how bad the movie it is. I like it. you know, the reality is, it doesn't matter how bad a movie is. There are still a lot of people on that film who put a lot of time and effort into
really
it.
Hard. Sure, hard. I couldn't do it.
And so I'm going to write a letter to every person on that film and tell them that like, you did not appreciate their work.
Oh, man. Did you appreciate that film?
I appreciated the work of the technicians on the background that did exactly what they're supposed to do.
I know the CGI
ACs, the AC guys pulled their focus. The CG guys spent months creating all this stuff. The catering people made sure everyone was fed. The drivers made sure everyone got to where they wanted to go.
All right,
the only people I don't appreciate was like the committee that's in the back. Yeah, this is the way that this movie has to be made. We need to have the perfectly distributed typecast like have all these people represented, but we still have to have like the white straight dude as the main protagonist.
His hot white girlfriend.
Yep. And then our token Asian people in order to sell in China.
I mean, yeah, you're not wrong.
No, I'm not.
Get that international
market.
I'm not
saying that as an Asian man. Half Asian. Quarter Asian.
I like how quickly that just went. A full Asian, half quarter. Like you're ashamed.
No, I'm not
ashamed. Diluted heritage.
I wish it was more, but yes, I'm quarter Asian.
All right. Anything else on your list you wanted to hit, David?
Let me look. Puzzles weren't clever. That scene was bad. The crowd crowd people are assholes.
I like the mystery of Holloway, like what he was, because he's like, is he really dead? Yes. Well, then what are you? And he just was like, thanks for playing my game, and walked out. It's like,
yeah,
oh.
That was an interesting moment. I feel like the CGI was sort of okay. Like overall, like on a scale of CGI, I thought it was okay.
Well,
it wasn't
again,
great. But
I
it was
think
okay.
They do get that pass just because it's a virtual world.
Yeah, this
so
is
it's not
this
supposed
is
to be, you know, realistic real life.
Okay. Oh yes. Here's one other thing. You have IOI, who has loyalty centers where they seemingly lock people in cubes and force them into indentured servitude.
Yeah.
That's not illegal. Holding a gun and attempted murder is still illegal, apparently, but indentured servitude is totally legal. It took a lot. And also blowing up. Blowing up, you know, probably and killing probably about, you know, 20, 30 people in the stacks.
Yeah.
Totally fine when you have branded company drones. Branded company drones to bomb.
Absolutely.
Completely
no legal.
Legal
repercussions
only
for an act of terrorism.
Only when a guy had attempted murder and hit another car did the police come.
Well, only when the screenwriter wanted the police to show up.
I was confused as far as like the actual setting of this world. Because I first got the impression that like when I saw the first teaser or whatever, the stacks, like it was just this one place. And everybody else like in the world was like is gone because it was like some sort of post-apocalyptic deal. But
it might
like,
as well
But then everyone else is one town. We were in a city. Like a perfectly fine city.
That's downtown. That's where all the rich people live. All the poor people live in the stacks. It's a dystopian young adult film because that's what sells right now. It's dystopian young adult films.
I think I did hear that in the books, the different characters are, you know, spread around the world.
Yeah,
but in here they're all in the same city.
Yeah, like
everybody.
I think I heard in the book. Spoiler for the book, like Wade doesn't even meet Artemis in person until the last chapter. Like it's after everything is finished that they actually meet.
What kind of director do you think Spielberg is? I know this is kind of like a step away, but like when I think of all the movies Spielberg does. Like, and he's lauded as like such a great director. And like when I think of Spielberg, I think of Schindler's List as like that being like just a super poignant and excellent film. But this just feels like it totally misses the mark. And I want like I'm just like where does like a name like Spielberg come into quality?
See, there's been this evolution of Spielberg. Because you have where he started and then you have where he is now.
Mm-hmm.
This movie is not where he is now. This movie was attempting to be where he was.
And that's what
I thought. This is supposed to be E.T.
Mm-hmm.
This is supposed to be...
Which
I'm
surprised there was not an E.T. reference.
That's a good point. It's like it's that era. It's like these movies that come out and like they're almost entirely for kids. And that's what it was supposed to be, but he's in this era of, you know, this post Schindler's List era. You know, he's coming off of Bridge of Spies, a, you know, Cold War thriller,
The Post.
Off The Post, all these adult films, which, from what I understand, are all very good films.
Yeah.
And they, you know, they get their share of Academy Awards and whatnot. And I feel like this is him trying to go back to that E.T. kind of thing. And I think I read a review that was like, you know, that was basically like Spielberg still got it, and I couldn't disagree more.
I honestly doubt the presence of Spielberg in this film as far as like his creative interest even, because
that committee, maybe the Bing reference had a little too much pull.
I think it's like, as an artist, as you age, your interest shifts to things that are among your peers. So he's able to more aptly take on subjects like The Post or Bridge of Spies, whereas I don't think he's got it in him to do anything remotely close to a youth film. And so I don't think he had the vision or the presence in this film like he did with his other work. I mean, yeah, you brought up Schindler's List. Far and away a much better film than this.
Yes.
And not in any way similar, but at least in that film you can feel a strong directorial vision. In this, it's like just shit thrown at the screen. I mean, I don't think Spielberg really was mentally, physically, spiritually there for this movie.
Yeah.
I really don't.
Yeah, I'm trying to think who would have been the next best choice for directing this film.
Yeah.
But I think there was an early review when they announced that Spielberg was directing it. Some people said, I think I was listening to a Rooster Teeth podcast, that their thought was part of the reason that he was attached was just because of his name as a way of forcing the IP rights holder's hand.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, Steven Spielberg is attached to this film. I will negotiate to let you use my content in there. Whereas if they had brought in Gareth Edwards or J.J. Abrams, even though those are bigger names, they don't have the pull of 30 years worth of cinematic
excellence. So it was more of like a marketing move to get Spielberg attached.
Absolutely.
I think so.
It,
I think maybe not that was the, there may not have been their sole purpose, but I'm sure that played
point.
I'm sure that played into it
at that point.
Yeah, I mean, it to me it just dilutes his credibility and you know how I think of his talent, you know. Red Letter Media made the joke of, Spielberg just had to show up and direct 11 minutes of live action film, and that was it. Like, just like, all right, I'm here, let's do this, and all right, see ya.
Yep.
Tell me when it's done. Write me the check. It's just really hard to look at his, you know, repertoire of films that everyone attributes to him, you know, getting big, like Jaws and Indiana Jones and Schindler's List and all the Saving Private Ryan, all the just great, amazing masterpiece films. It's just so hard to see this as in the same in the same library. So I agree. I think, you know, David, you're right. Maybe it's a marketing move, like most things are these days, especially for big attempted blockbuster films. It's got to be this big smash hit that we just have to really hit hard with.
Yep.
So to wrap up, I wouldn't recommend this film. I think you should go see A Quiet Place. I want to go see Quiet Place.
I do want to see A Quiet Place too.
That's got a 95%. This movie, by the way, has like a 73 on Rotten Tomatoes.
Really?
That's travesty.
Yep. I was trying to find out what their budget was. I can't find their budget right now. But it looks like as of yesterday, they made like $125 million.
Ready Player One?
Yeah, which I'm sure cost them a lot more than that to make.
Yeah.
I'd be bailing there.
It seems kind of low for me.
That's how much they made.
Yeah, I know. It seems a little low. I mean, I feel like they're going to probably make more than that.
Well, we'll see. Sorry, no recommendation from me. Same with you guys.
Nope, Ready Player One is not ready.
So we will probably have to balance it out next month by seeing a good movie. Still to be determined.
See, you say that.
Well, you know.
No, David.
What is my track record with good movies on this podcast? And you tell me what the odds are that the next one will be good.
I mean,
my book.
fingers crossed on that. But thank you so much for listening to the Indie Film Toolkit podcast. We'll be back next episode with a lot of other cool stuff. See you then.
Bye.
Go.